It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Vary Show is on the air.
When I was growing up, my parents wanted me to be a doctor. My dad is a severe, very brittle diabetic and has been under the care of doctors for his pancreas, liver, kidneys, circulation, a big problem with diabetics. And in one way or another, when we interacted with doctors, it was always such a great deal of respect. And I've always had such a healthy respect for these men and women who are applied scientists who wish to heal, and it's a calling, right? It's a very high calling. And the industry itself, people who wish to reduce or ameliorate our pain, help us live longer, help us be happier, this was always something that was taken for granted. And somewhere along the way, that mission, that goal, that ministry has seemed to derail. And it is almost as if that profession and that field has become sort of an outreach or an outgrowth of ideology related to something other than providing healthcare. Dr. Stanley Goldfarb has written a book called Take Two Aspirin and Call Me by My Pronouns: Why Turning Doctors into Social Justice Warriors is Destroying American Medicine. Dr. Goldfarb, I'll start by asking you, where was medicine and where did you notice it going wrong in your 53 years of practice? So you have a good baseline to start with. Where was medicine? Where did it start going wrong? And what were the indicators you started seeing of change?
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show. It has been a rather long journey, something that began actually in the days after World War II, where the rise of communism actually and the intrusion of Marxism into many governments had adherents in the United States and around the world, and there were a number of individuals who saw that medicine ought to take a socialist turn. And that, of course, led to the National Health Service in England. In the United States, it was resisted, but there was a strong academic interest in some of these ideas, and they've been sort of relentlessly pursued over the past several years and have sort of exploded, I would say, in the last 10 years, where it became very apparent that individuals who were guiding American medicine were interested in taking these socialist ideas, actually Marxist ideas, and injecting them into medical education. And those who were trained in that era have started to become leaders of medicine themselves, and they have furthered this sort of ideology. So I would say about in the last 5 to 10 years, it's really become obvious to those inside the world of medicine. And over the last few years, starting with the so-called, awakening to racism in the United States after the George Floyd killing, it's become something that's, I think, become quite newsworthy and apparent to, even patients as they're starting to seek medical care.
So the book is Take Two Aspirin and Call Me by My Pronouns: Why Turning Doctors into Social Justice Warriors is Destroying American Medicine. You use terms like Marxism. And we often use socialism and even communism. But give me some examples of how, as patients, because all of us are either seeing doctors now or our parents are, give me some examples of how that affects us as a patient and why we should care.
Sure. Well, one of the most striking examples came during the end of the COVID epidemic, when drugs became available that would start to minimize some of the symptoms, for example, the monoclonal antibodies and some of the medications now that are available, the oral medications to reduce symptoms once somebody develops the disease. Well, it turns out that a number of states, Utah in particular was one example, and several institutions created algorithms whereby it was determined who would receive what was then very scarce medications based on their risk factors. And one of the risk factors that was inserted was somebody's race. So someone who was a person of color, particularly an African-American patient, would get 2 points towards a 4 to 6 point requirement that they would have to fulfill before they would be eligible for the medication. So I think this was the first glaring example where racial concepts and really political ideologies that we need to treat races differently because of past discrimination became apparent in healthcare. And subsequently, there have been other examples. One of those very famous hospitals that is affiliated with Harvard Medical School decided that it was going to treat patients differently depending on their skin color. Patients who had a form of congestive heart failure, a very common medical problem, who came into the emergency room were going to be referred to have their choice of where they were going to be referred in the hospital, whether to a specialty floor or a general medical floor, if they were black patients. White patients would not be given that opportunity. So we're starting to see ideology creep into the practice of medicine, actual practice of medicine, influencing the kind of treatment that individuals would receive. And when I wrote my book, when I started my book, even these horrible examples were not evident, but I was aware that this was the sort of mentality that was being injected into the healthcare world and particularly into medical education. And that's what spurred me on to write the book.
Dr. Goldfarb, we know that, for instance, sickle cell anemia affects blacks almost exclusively. We know that Tay-Sachs affects Ashkenazi Jews and, as it turns out, the Amish and Cajuns, but a very limited group. But by and large, is there much of a difference when you take out culture and eating habits and things like that? Is there much of a difference between treating a black person, a white person, a Hispanic person, an Asian person for most of their bodily functions?
No. And in fact, the very idea that, you know, physicians in any systematic way would consider these issues when treating a patient is just so really absurd. And certainly from the question you're asking, is there a medical requirement to treat people differently? There are some subtle differences that one has to apply based on somebody's race. The idea that there's no genetic influences on race is ridiculous. A gene controls skin color, for example. There are other genes that control aspects of human development and of disease susceptibility. So these have to be taken into account, but only in special, very special circumstances. When we see patients, we see patients. We don't see black patients or white patients or yellow patients or anything like that. We see patients, and we try to do the best for those patients. And I think that represents a dynamic that is really embedded in the American healthcare system. And I've had many physicians since the book came out and since some other publications that I've been able to put out have all mentioned this to me, that, you know, they see these patients as almost as family members, and would, it's just an abhorrent idea that they would treat them differently based on their race, even though this is the mentality that's starting to become prominent in American medicine.
I'm going to hold you right there. Hang right there. We'll have more of this conversation coming up.
You've got
The Michael Berry Show.
Dr. Stanley Goldfarb has written a book called Take Two Aspirin and Call Me By My Pronouns, Why Turning Doctors into Social Justice Warriors
is destroying American medicine. Dr. Goldfarb, so Do No Harm, as it's listed in quotes, is this an organization that you're a part of?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you know, once the book was out and written, then the question was, okay, how can we influence some of these trends that I saw as being such a problem? And we began this organization, Do No Harm. We have a website, donoharmmedicine.org, where people, patients, doctors, can see more of our materials. But we started that organization. It's a membership organization, and its goal is to give a voice to physicians, other people in the healthcare world, medical students, and patients who experience these sorts of indignities and a sense that they're being treated differently because of race or being asked to treat patients differently because of race. And we've had, you know, literally hundreds of tips, if you will, of people writing into us using our website to tell us about circumstances. For example, there was one physician who was told us, and we'll be publishing an op-ed on this, about the fact that he's giving up his Massachusetts license because he's been forced to take implicit bias training as part of his continuing medical education. And he was so offended by this because he felt like he treated black patients and every patient the same, and that there was absolutely no hint of bias in any of the kinds of medical care that he had provided over the years. And yet he was being accused basically of that kind of behavior and being forced to take a course in this really the absurd idea that he's a biased individual simply because he's white and his patients may not be white. And he's giving up his Massachusetts license. He lives in another state, so it's not as if he's giving up his career, but he's making a point, making a statement about how this kind of mentality just poisons medical care. And let me just say specifically why this harms black patients, because patients need to have the trust of their physicians. If they don't trust them, then they're not going to accept advice, they're not going to follow recommendations, and the outcomes are going to be worse. And once organizations and healthcare systems and federal governments and state governments start declaring that there's racism in medical care, how can patients be trustful of their physician? It undermines the trust that black patients need to have, and it's just a terrible thing. And it undermines the comfort of white patients who feel like maybe they're being treated differently because they're white. So this absurdity just has to be stopped, and that's our goal with Do No Harm.
In researching your organization and what y'all do, I came across donoharmfilm.com. I'm assuming y'all are associated with that.
No, I think, you know, there are a lot of, Do No Harm comes, the phrase comes from the Hippocratic
sure.
Oath. And so I think a lot of organizations have adopted it over the years. But no, our specific our website is
donoharmmedicine.org. Okay, yep.
.org.
I had two notes. I wasn't sure if there was an association.
Yes.
It wasn't clear. They seem to be kind of sharing some of the things
yes.
y'all are doing. So when you talk to other doctors, are doctors experiencing this and afraid to speak out? Are they speaking out and they're not being heard? Or doctors, you have 53 years of experience, but even some younger doctors know that there was a world before this nonsense. What are they saying?
Yes, they're upset. I mean, there are a lot of doctors that are upset. There are doctors who obviously go along with this mentality or else it wouldn't be, you know, developing. But many doctors, like the gentleman from Massachusetts, I've gotten many, many emails, phone calls, and even some from my own institution. I was on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania for all my whole career, and even some of my colleagues there, and it sees itself as another woke, if you will, institution, feel that this is what I'm saying is really quite correct, that in the name of this kind of racial ideology, and in the name of weakening medical education standards, which is another theme of my book, that we've made a terrible mistake and that this really needs to be stopped. And so, again, any collection of educated people will have different opinions, but there's a strong view out there that this kind of development in medicine is a problem and needs to be confronted and needs to be fought against.
And what kind of response are you getting from organized medicine, particularly hospital systems and the American Medical Association and faculty and things? What's been the response?
Sure. So there were two letters to the Wall Street Journal that were published in response to our announcement about the Do No Harm organization. And one was from the Association of American Medical Colleges. Now, that's the leadership organization of American Medical School. Its board is made up of the deans of medical schools. And they claim that, that it's important to teach about social justice and that we can't really diagnose and treat patients adequately unless we understand their social conditions. And my question to them, my response to them was basically, what are you talking about? If someone has an illness, we have to treat the illness. Now, if we need to know that they can get their medications, we need to know that they can get transportation to the hospital. Those are questions that we always ask patients. We always inquired of them. And if they had difficulties, we asked social workers to help them maneuver through those kinds of difficulties. But beyond that, I need to treat the individual patient. I don't need to treat his community. I don't need to treat her neighborhood. I don't need to treat any social conditions under which they live. I can't influence them. And yet, that was the claim that they made. So that was one argument that they put forth. But they never explained the link between how somebody lives in a neighborhood that might be a violent neighborhood and how that leads to more leukemia, for example, which has been proposed even in the literature. Crazy things like that. The second response we got was from the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, they created a protocol where patients were given their choice if they were Black, which unit in the hospital they would be admitted to if they had a particular kind of cardiac problem. And they wrote back and said that they've never done anything like this, and they had no intention of doing that. Well, they unfortunately, there is a body of literature that they've produced. They've actually recommended such a program and started to institute it back in March of last year. Now, maybe they changed their minds, but in March of last year, they wrote a very long piece in the Boston Review explaining how they were going to create this kind of differential program. So I think, organized academic medicine is upset with me because no one has really called them to task over these issues. It's something that's been developing, and there's been no organized response to it and no organizations like Do No Harm that have stepped up and said, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're just not going to take it. This is wrong and somebody needs to combat it.
I appreciate your 53 years in service to humanity and a number of years before that to be academically prepared to do so. But I particularly appreciate the fact that you're willing to put all that capital on the line for the greater good that will hopefully outlast all of us. Dr. Stanley Goldfarb, the book is Take Two Aspirin and Call Me by My Pronouns, Why Turning Doctors into Social Justice Warriors is Destroying American Medicine. And you can find more on the website, donoharmmedicine.org. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you so much.
The Michael Barry Show continues. I can't get it on my own.
Always imagine in this latest
Beatles documentary kind of probably disappointed me for this reason, but when you, it's one of the rare times that you see the other members of a group. It's one of the rare times you see the first time someone other than the author of a piece perform that piece. How many times do you think you've heard November Rain in your life? Wouldn't it be interesting if you could go back? I would have been, I don't know, probably 15, 16 years old. What year was November? Maybe 17. I bet it was, was it 87? Was it in the 90s? November Rain was the 90s? But I love that song. And it's epic when it opens. It is epic. That's not an exaggeration. I know we don't overuse that word, but it is just telling you. 91, wow. If you watch the latest Beatles biography, you see Paul come in and start banging out Hey Jude. And they're watching it for the, George, I think, is watching it for the first time. And they don't know they have, you know, one of the greatest songs of all time in front of them. They just, okay, all right. And they changed a few words around and the song grew. I don't know why I brought that up. I just found it interesting. I watched a documentary the other day. I can never remember whether it's Netflix or Amazon, so don't waste the time emailing me to tell me or to ask me. Just find it. But it's called In Search of Greatness. And it has a lot to do with a theme you've heard me espouse a lot lately. And it's got Pelé and Gretzky and Jerry Rice. But what I love about it is it goes into the fact that none of these three were physical specimens. None of these three would have been assumed to become one of the greatest of their sport of all time based on early performance or, you know, if these guys that all want to use statistics to replace the gut of who's good and who's not. Well, none of them could jump the highest or run the fastest or do any of the physical things that are supposedly so important to be an elite athlete. None of them scored high on those. Because what you cannot measure is grit. What you cannot measure is determination. Some people have that it factor, and almost everyone else does not. And you know somebody when they have, you want to be around them. You want to be in their presence. You want them on your team. You want them in your organization. You want to marry them. You want to be friends with them. You want to do business with them. There are just certain people who have something that is special. It's different. It's unlike what others do. But I would like to use that as an example. These elite athletes, they go into Jordan as well. And they talk about how long they practice. They talk about their commitment to excellence. It's called In Search of Perfection. And I'm sorry, In Search of Greatness. It's called In Search of Greatness. I wrote it down. It's called In Search of Greatness. It's 1 hour. And I wish it was 5 hours because I could have watched what this message was so powerful. And we have gotten away from, in American society today, in our schools, on our teams, everywhere, the everybody gets a trophy was a symptom of the problem, not the problem itself. We have gotten away from the idea that sacrifice and suffering in pursuit of excellence is divine. It is good. It is why our country was so successful for so long. But again, we'll talk to a guest, Yoran Hazony, later on in the show today. He's an Israeli author and Bible scholar, and he makes the point that when religion left the public space in America, that space was filled by the neo-Marxists, and that's what we're experiencing. The neo-Marxists do not absolutely do not believe in, respect, promote the ideas of hard work, of competition. These are the hallmark of what make us great. These are the hallmark of what have made us great. In business, in innovation, you look at a guy like Steve Jobs and his commitment to excellence. What do the neo-Marxists say? Well, he's not a good guy. The neo-Marxists are now rewriting the Steve Jobs story to tell you that he wasn't a very nice boss. No, he wasn't. He wasn't out to make friends. He was out to make a difference. And he did. You've got people who now want to say that Steve Jobs was too demanding of his employees. If he hadn't been, you wouldn't be carrying around that thing in your hand today with all the capabilities it has. I was told by an astronaut, that there is more technology in your cell phone you're carrying in your pocket than in all the computers combined at NASA when we went to the moon. We can't just take for granted that there would have been all these developments, that this would have happened. It happened because people made it happen. Songs don't just exist in the ether, they have to be written. Things aren't just invented. Cancer isn't just defeated. These things have to be done by pursuing excellence.
It's the Michael Berry Show, Michael Berry.
I saw a news headline and then dug into it because I'm interested in this issue. Bank of America clients hoard cash at highest level in two decades. After a long bull market, most Americans now fear a bear market. After years of up, they fear it must come down. So they're pulling their cash, their money out of equities, out of stocks. They're reducing or removing their risk and putting it into safe, stable, but not nearly as exciting investment like bonds or just holding on to cash. Warren Buffett's engaged in some very interesting behavior right now, but I'll get to that in a minute. The headline was Bank of America clients hoard cash at highest levels in two decades. You know, when I was growing up, people used to hide cash, like cash. They'd put it in a mattress or inside the freezer. Remember in the old TV shows? The joke was always that someone had hidden their money in a coffee can. Buried in the backyard, then they'd dig up their yard because they'd forgotten where they buried the loot. You got to remember, when those shows were made, when people still hid their money, we weren't too far removed from the Great Depression. People didn't trust banks. They didn't want to go online and look at all their numbers. They wanted the comfort of knowing their cash was at their house. The run on the banks in the Great Depression destroyed the trust in financial institutions. And just like I've said, women don't care about abortion today because it's been legal for 50 years. They don't care that it be legal. They've always known of it being legal. So the idea that it might be illegal doesn't matter to most of them. They don't think about that. They're past that age anyway. So too, people don't think about whether you can trust the bank or not. They're looking for convenience. Can I go online and is there an ATM on every corner? Can I go on my phone and transfer money? Now you've got Zelle and what's the other one, Ramon? Venmo and all these things. My wife is constantly saying to somebody, somebody's kid goes somewhere with us and the mom will say, I'll pay you back. I'll Venmo it. I don't even know how all that stuff works. Not even going to lie. I mean, I got an idea how it works. But people didn't trust banks for a very long time. Now the idea of hiding your cash seems foreign, right? You'd figure that's real sketchy, but used to. What about when you go to the beach? You got cash in your wallet. What do you do with that cash in your wallet?
The things that people do to stop criminals is, to me, it's always like, my favorite one is people, when you go to the beach, you go in the water, put your wallet in the sneaker, who's gonna know? Right? Yeah. What criminal mind would check there, you know? They'll dig in the sand. They won't look in shoes, you know.
It's so true, though. The story I always think about when you think about hiding cash in your mattress or wherever else, because that was a popular one. It was about 10 years ago, and a family had replaced an elderly family member's mattress. You got to figure it was old, stained. And they found out she had hidden her life savings inside that mattress.
Stashing your cash in a mattress may seem like a good idea in these hard economic times. That is, unless you toss the mattress away. In the ultimate case of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, an Israeli family is frantically searching through garbage dumps, hoping to find the mattress they threw out that had $1 million inside. According to the family, they bought a new mattress for an elderly relative and put the old one out with the trash. It wasn't until it was too late that they remembered she had stowed her life savings in there, a cool $1 million. This man runs one of the dumps the family contacted and says as soon as he heard the story, he called in everyone he could think of to search for the hidden treasure. Of course, he also says they get thousands of tons of garbage every day, including hundreds of mattresses. He also adds that if the mattress was in decent condition, there's a good chance a homeless person nabbed it, and the answers to their problems could be right under their head. Ed Donahue, The Associated Press.
I like that story. It reminds me of the old story about, it was on Andy Griffith's show, and Opie goes to Andy, his dad, to tell him that the price of his allowance has gone up. And Andy takes the moment to firmly but gently teach Opie the value of working for money. And this is a good lesson that Washington needs to learn. Stop spending money you haven't earned. The American people can't afford it anymore.
Now, what's this about rules for pas and sons?
This first. The 75-cent rule.
The 75-cent rule. I don't believe I ever heard of that one.
Well, that's what I figured. What it is, Pa, is that nowadays, kids get 75 cents a week allowance instead of 25 cents.
75 cents? That's a lot of money. And in a year's time, I'd come to see there's 52 weeks in a year.
It comes to around $40 a year.
That's an awful lot of money for a young.
They get it, Pa.
They do, huh?
And they don't have to work for it like I do.
Hmm. Well, who is this they you keep talking about?
Oh, Arnold Winkler and everybody.
Arnold Winkler? I don't believe I know him, do I?
They're new from Raleigh.
Oh, I see. And the Raleigh rules say 75 cents and no work, huh?
I guess.
Mm-hmm. You want it straight, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here it goes. There are no rules for pas and sons. It's as simple as this. Each mother or father raises his boy or girl, as the case may be, the way that he thinks is best. And I think it's best for you to get a quarter and work for it. You see, when you give something, in this instance, cleaning the garage, and you get something in return, like a quarter, well, that's the greatest feeling in the world. You do feel good after working, don't you?
Uh-huh. Good and tired.
Well, as you get bigger, well, you'll be doing more and more work for more and more return, and that good feeling will get bigger. You understand what I mean?
I think so.
Good.
I'm not going to get the 75 cents. And I have to work for the 25.
Right. All clear to you?
Yeah. The bigger you get, the tireder you get.
Well, you just think about that for a while.
Do I have to?
Don't you want to think about it?
It makes me kind of sad.
Well, the thing to do when you're feeling sad is to shoot for the good feeling.
Clean the garage.
Right.
So long, Paul.
So long, Paul.